Welcome to the smuggest podcast in human existence. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. Look, folks, I'm not going to lie to you. I have two podcast co-hosts that are looking unbelievably fucking smug right now. And this is going to be a very long hour. So let's just get this shit over with. I'm Dre Harrison. Welcome to episode 585 of Motorsport 101. And I'm not an Alex Palou supporter. But if I was, I'd be grinning like these two Cheshire Cat-looking motherfuckers over here. Let's get this out of the way. Hello, Cameron Buckley.
Now describe what you're wearing in this moment. Describe your state of being.
I can't. It is beyond human words, human language. I am wearing the Alex Palou shirt that I bought at the Milwaukee Mile last year, where that was a potential title killer round for Alex Palou, where his battery failed. And I was wearing this shirt in the stands. I was wearing this shirt again on Sunday.
I think nothing else redeemed.
You know, RJ, I have to say, you might not have heard of him, but this guy lit the world up in Super Formula last year. I think he's going to be a big deal when he comes to IndyCar.
Let's see here. I'd like to pull up a post. This post was dated December 19th, 2019. Alex Palou says he's speechless. He'll be driving an IndyCar next season for Dale Coyne Racing with Team Go. Cannot thank enough all humans that made this possible. Dreams do come true. You're so right, Alex. You are so right.
I think this kid turned out pretty okay.
Like I said, long hour.
Well, Harrison, I mean, who did you pick for the 500?
Really? We're going here already?
Places you can find us. All of our written material and podcasts on motorsport101.com. And if you really like our work, subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of these diversions, and $10 gets you into the supporters section of our Discord, where you can listen to every episode as it's being recorded.
Yeah, what he said. Places you can find us beyond that, youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Blue Sky, respectively, at Dre Harrison, wsky.social, cbuckley917, and RJ O'Connell. Follow them. They're smug as shit about it. We're also on Instagram, motorsport101pod. You can check your photo of us out there for highlights of the show. You can watch these two being smug as shit about it. Because we are indeed now partially a visual medium. So, and there's also reviews of everything to come out of most likely be the final day of classics that you'll likely see in modern day motorsport if Monaco is set to be moved. So that's the Monaco Grand Prix, that's MotoGP's Grand Prix of the United Kingdom, and of course the Indy 500, which we'll be talking about very, very shortly, as well as a bonus review of the first two episodes of the F1 Academy series that's launched on Netflix today, as I record this. I was lucky enough to be invited down to the premiere for it, so that was neat, I suppose. So do check that out if you haven't already. And yeah, you know everywhere else you can find us already, so do check that out if you haven't already. Right, let's get this over with. Let's review the 109th running of the Indianapolis 500.
It was a 500 that started with drama before we even had the first green flag of the day, which was withheld due to rain showers. Past the scheduled 12:45 Eastern Daylight Time starting point, because Scott McLaughlin from the fourth row crashed on the final warm-up lap, spinning out while trying to warm his tires, ending his race before it had even started. It really felt like 1992. And then we had five more cautions in the first 100 laps of this year's Indy 500. Marco Andretti, when we finally went green, his Indy 500 lasted about half a mile of green flag racing. He was taken out as a result of the hip check from the two dry Ryan Bull cars checking up in front of him. Then there was a 10-lap caution for rain. Rinus VK crashed coming into the pits with a brake failure. Kyle Larson spun out due to a money ship on lap 92, taking Tiff and Simpson and Stingray Rob out of the race with him. And then Christian Rasmussen spun out on lap 106 just before they were about to go back to green. Rasmussen
He didn't spin. He just four-wheel drifted for a really long time and didn't hit anything.
How did he keep getting away with this?
I don't know, man. That is one of the best saves you'll ever see on a racetrack.
Go back and check it out. The rest of the race stayed clean. Joseph Newgarden, for the 11th row, clawed his way back into the top five before a fuel pump failure ended his hopes of a three-peat. I told you. A similar failure would happen for Ryan Hunter-Reay, who got back on sequence down the stretch and had a genuine chance to take Dreyer Ryan Bull Racing to victory lane, setting up a three-way fight for the win between Marcus Ericsson at full power after a short fuel to get back in front, Alex Palou having to hit his number, and David Malukas in the AJ Penske Foyt. Palou passed Ericsson with 14 to go to get to the front and would use the two lap-down RLO cars of Louis Foster and Devlin DeFrancesco to lead until the final lap and save as much fuel as he needed. And then Nolan Siegel crashed in the wall, bringing out a caution at the fourth corner to end the race. Alex Palou is finally a winner on an oval and at the biggest race of him them all. Gentlemen, thoughts?
Before we start, Cam, you might want to turn that fan off. It's a bit overarchingly loud on your end. I don't know why it doesn't normally kick up on your mic like that, but yeah, it's perfect. Carry on.
What's there to say? It's the final flourish on the masterpiece has been painting since the start of this season.
His fifth win in six races, a 115-point lead in the championship going into the Detroit Grand Prix, which I will be at.
He is as close to Pato O'Ward in second in points as Pato O'Ward is to Nolan Siegel.
In 19th.
I like how in the post-race gala, Scott Dixon was trying to convince him to take an all-expense-paid five-week vacation starting Thursday. Anything he needs.
The terrifying thing is he could take that vacation and he'd still probably come back as championship leader.
That's right, because there's enough points at hand that Alex Palou could take Detroit off. He could then take the Nets race off. And he would still be in the championship lead no matter what Pato O'Ward or anybody else in this field does.
It's terrifying.
I don't know what to add. This wasn't your classic crushingly dominant 500. This wasn't your dogfight to the end. He won this race the exact way he lost it back in 2021 to Elio Castroneves, where Elio worked the traffic and then was able to draft all the way to the end.
He picked something up back then. Yeah, to your point, and I'm sure Dre will agree with me, the vibes of this race were so, so weird.
It was a weird feeling 500. I mean, it was frustrating to start off with, of course, no one's fault. Mother Nature decided to mess with us a little bit at the start. We had a half an hour long rain delay before we even got going. We had sprinkles again for a good 15 minutes early on as well, which that was a 10-lap caution. Again, just one of those things you had to avoid. There was the overarching theme that Kyle Larson was not going to make the end of the race because of the rain delays as well, because he had to be on the plane for 4:30 Eastern. So again, even if it wasn't for the crash he ultimately had, he would not have made it. They'd have probably parked him with about 40 or 50 laps to go, which is unfortunate.
And we learned that Tony Kanaan could not jump in. That's something I learned about the rules, that Gendo Ikari did not have to get back into the EVA.
Yep. Driver changes are no longer allowed after green. So the moment Larson took the green, he was committed at that point. So the whole idea about Tony Kanaan being a reserve driver really, like, either McLaren didn't read the rules properly or they did read the rules properly and then were trying to con everybody, because this whole idea about Kanaan being a reserve was always going to be bullshit. Because the only way Larson wasn't going to take the green to start the race is if there was a huge rain delay, which was never forecast in the first place.
Yeah.
Then again, it wouldn't be like the first time McLaren's tried to cock tease anybody in motorsport in recent years. Anyway.
It's a cold race. A lot of carnage early on. I mean,
bunch of crashes. I mean, we had one before the race even started. We had one right as the race officially started. And I think, what, fourth coldest 500 on record. And the cold ones are always a little bit wild because you don't have the tire temperature and the engines are making a little bit more power because they're happier in the cold.
And it felt like these cars were slow through the corners once we had, like, restarts and everything. Like, dog,
It was treacherous out there. Again, a little bit of moisture in the air, which probably didn't help. You know, like you said, fourth coldest 500 ever. Coldest since 1992, the year I was born. You know, and a lot of packing up on restarts. I mean, Marco Andretti, I feel bad for the guy. I mean, that was nearly a four wide going into the first corner of the of green flag running. That was never going to work out in the end. It's almost like everybody was being extra cautious, and as a result, somebody got wrecked as a result. And yeah, it was a weird. I mean, the vibes were weird, mostly because the first half of this race was so patchy. And then we had 94 laps of green flag running to the end, which you don't get a 500 very often at all.
Yeah.
And even after it was all said and done, like, we didn't have a completely balls-to-the-wall finish because we had a caution on lap 200 on the final lap, and the awkwardness of not knowing if Nolan Siegel was okay or not.
He was, thankfully.
But thankfully he was in the end. But yeah, we only got like a 3-second screenshot of Siegel backwards in a wall and like, oh, well, shit, that's unfortunate. Hey, Alex Palou's one, isn't that cool? You know, again, TV broadcasting, you kind of have to do it that way, but it's unfortunate how that played out. Bad timing. You had two, you know, you had one surprise contender have a heartbreak, which was Ryan Hunter-Reay, who was back on sequence and had a genuine shot at it. Joseph Newgarden, who drove his nuts off to get back into the top five. I would have loved to have seen how that finish would have played out if he was still there, because as well, I think it was genuinely quite hard to pass in these cars in this 500. Yeah. I don't know how much of that's down to the hybrid or how much of that was down to the cold weather or the conditions in general. I'm not sure where you apportion responsibility for something like that, but
I would say a little bit of both, because the cold conditions, also with the air being denser, made fuel consumption significantly worse. And Palou talked about after the race, he pretty much spent that whole race fuel saving until the last five or six laps.
There was also significant portions where a lot of drivers were using alternate strategies to get up the field, and we had to track like the net leader of the race, which you hardly ever do in a super speedway race in IndyCar.
No. And again, it got more confusing because he didn't get a caution late on to shuffle the pack around. Once we got to lap 106, we were green the whole way through. So we had to spend a lot more time in green flag running, working out who was on strategy A, who was on strategy B, who was the net leader, you know. And again, even Alex Palou admitted after the race itself that he was telling his team, sod the fuel save, because he was adamant there'd be at least one more caution that never came. And it's the way it played out. Marcus Ericsson was in the lead of that race with 15 to go because he was able to get back on sequence with a short fill. And that's ultimately what gave us the final battle. And Palou sending it down the inside with 14 to go. It was a brilliant pass. And Marcus was mad at himself for letting Palou get away with that one, essentially. I will throw my two colleagues a bone here for a second, because They've been smug as shit, and they've not been smug enough compared to what I thought they were going to be. As you said, Polo has been painting, if anything, 2025 is not doing him enough justice. He's been painting a masterpiece in IndyCar since 2022, really. And he's been the best driver in IndyCar pretty much since then, barring a team scandal, sadly, of his own making, really. Beyond that, he's been the best driver in the series ever since. Yep. This oval win was coming. This was not a fluke. This was not a weakness in Alex's game. He just needed the right set of circumstances to make this work. Yep. And it's not like Polo got there on strategy, or he got there via an alternate plan or some kind of shenanigans to do it. This was consistent with the way this race had played out over the last fortnight of prep. He was one of the strongest cars all fortnight long. Had a 233-mile-an-hour run on day one of the time trials. Was top six to start off with. Was consistently fast. Toe, no toe. The conditions didn't matter. Polo was up there in every circumstance. It's like when Marcus won it in 2022. People say, oh, is this a fluke? He's just an F1 guy that got lucky. You look back at those times, Ericsson was top 10 in every practice. In every session, he was in play as a contender. People just didn't pay attention to it because there were bigger names at the front.
Yeah, there were bigger names within his own team back then. But this year, Alex Palou could not go under the radar.
Well, and like you say that pretty much the whole way through this race, it was beware the man who lies quietly in wait, because he was just in fourth to sixth basically the whole time, just saving fuel. I don't think we saw him at 100% at any stage of that race until he slammed his car up the inside of Ericsson in turn one to take the lead.
By the way, he needed to, because with Ericsson on newer tires with less fuel to save in that final stint.
No fuel to save. He was full power the whole time. But critically, like 2021, you could get to the front and save fuel because the front wasn't the front. The two RLL cars of Louis Foster and Devlin DeFrancesco were towing the lead pack around.
They were hoping for a caution that never came so they could cycle back into the queue and maybe have a chance to gain more positions. That ultimately never happened.
Yeah. The RLL cars weren't so slow that the whole pack just drag raced them. They were fast enough to lead on merit.
Yeah, once they were there, the chasing pack couldn't get past them. They were just there swapping around. Like, RLL had generally a pretty good 500, all things considered. They weren't elite. I mean, Takuma Sato, they're more than anybody else.
I am very sad. Takuma Sato looked like Unk still had it all the way through the first half of this race, really more.
He led 51 laps of this race more than any other driver in the field, and it was all legit. He was the number one man on the Alpha strategy for the first half of the race. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he slides in too deep on one of his pit stops, misses his cue. The stop is slow anyway, and he just plummets all the way down the order. I'm telling you what, ninth place does not really reflect the quality of race that Takuma Sato had. We don't know how many more of these he's got left in him. Again, appreciate the performance that he put in this week.
And to add to that, I mean, that performance with two broken ribs. I never thought in my entire life I needed to hear Takuma Sato barking, "Jesus Christ," during a victory gala, talking about how bad it was every time he sneezed or laughed pretty much all month. He broke a couple ribs in that crash. He was getting Toradol shots every time he had to climb into the car.
I've been told that is immensely painful. Like coughing or sneezing when you've broken a rib is apparently excruciating. So driving a race car at 230 miles an hour sounds like a terrible fucking idea. There's a few things I want to mention as the minor stories. Another one was, let me rip the band-aid off this one because I've been rinsed for it enough as it is. I picked Scott McLaughlin to win this race. And for the second time today, we had someone on the grass on the side of a racing track crumpled over in a heap in tears. We'll talk about the other one later on this week. But
That's gutting. Because, like, I wanted to see what McLaughlin could have done in that battle. Because you mentioned it, Joseph Newgarden had a hell of a race car. How would Scott McLaughlin have done, knowing that he didn't have to start as far back?
I really genuinely thought this was going to be the year for McLaughlin from day one. I picked him for both for a reason. He's gotten better and better every year he's been in IndyCar. He was one of the few people who could take the fight to Pillow legitimately last year. And I think he was the second best driver in IndyCar this year until we got to the month of May. He was in the top six every weekend except for the Thermal Club, where he was taken out by Devlin. So I thought I was on the right track with this pick until that practice crash that happened, and that kind of derailed his weekend. And then, of course, that happened. I mean, look, he's not the first person to do it. He won't be the last. Yeah, I don't think he needs me to tell him that was embarrassing, because he's probably, whatever I'd say, he's probably not going to be anywhere near as bad as what he's probably already told himself for doing what he did. And, you know, also
Dixon from 22 years ago.
Indeed. And, you know, it was the cherry on top of a trifle made of dog shit for Penske over the last 2 weeks, all things considered. Just a horrible, no good, terrible, embarrassing 500 for Team Penske. And their best car was 16th and a lap down.
Yeah, and lucky to get up to 16th, given we have not ripped the other bandage off of this race. Yeah, I mean, even if when you go over to the Coke 600, somehow Penske's month of May gets even worse, given they have one competitive car over there, and Ryan Blaney got terminated by Daniel Suarez late in the race.
Yeah.
You know, last year they won our Beat 'Em Down Excellence Award for their month of May. Their month of May this year might be prime Golden Cock territory.
I'd say it's at least floppy worthy for this race alone. Will Power gets 16th in the end, and you mentioned it. Joseph Newgarden was clawing his way up to the front. Now
he was phenomenal.
Drove the balls off that Penske. He only could. But much like every other three-peat attempt, cut short at the end by something. In this case, a fuel pump failure right after what would have been his second to final stop.
Yeah, and Penske was nailing those pit stops all race long. That's their ace in the hole that they don't talk about. And unless Penske has some, like, mechanic doping system that we don't know about, we know that is always above board. But I said it, Joseph was not going to three-peat. I knew in my heart he wasn't going to, but he came a lot closer to it than I thought he would have for about two-thirds of this race.
Didn't they win the pit crew contest as well?
Yes.
Yes, competing with themselves in the finals. Yeah.
It goes to show you. Team. Oh, get the jokes in about Penske competing against themselves. The jokes write themselves. It's a shame for Joseph. And it's one of those, hey, you can joke about the heel turn of Joseph all you want, but the man drove his nuts off in that instance. And I have to respect that. That was a phenomenal performance. And that was a reminder as to why Newgarden has been the best oval racer in IndyCar for the last half decade. That was sensational from him. And it's a shame he's got nothing to show for it, and that's effectively the end of his season, given he's now 200 points off the top.
I think this race was the end of a lot of people's seasons, all things considered. If you need to start chipping away at Pillow's championship lead, you failed summarily.
Game over, essentially. You just lost another 50 points to Alex, who came away with 58 at the end of the month of May's running. The small matter that Pillow swept the month of May.
The only points paying thing he didn't sweep was the qualifying for the 500. He didn't even need to. I mean, to that effect, Pillow now goes to a average finish in 2025 of 1.17.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. I mean, we're dancing around Pillow. We'll talk about him a little bit more later as well. But there's a few other little things I want to get around as well and talk about. But it's startling. It's frightening when you read shit like that about just what he's doing right now. Again, more on that in a little bit. We're gonna dance around the one because it's such a massive unanimous race to talk about.
Ericsson. Because he was second on the road. He was so close. And then he, Kyle Kirkwood, and Callum Ilott were all effectively disqualified from the race, set to the back for failing post-race technical inspection. It bumped a bunch of guys up the field, and it means that Marcus Ericsson, once again, so close at the Indy 500 to his second win. If circumstances had gone a bit different, he could be a three-time winner at the Speedway. Instead, he gets third to last place for all of his efforts for a big boo-boo on the part of Andretti Global.
It's kind of wild that Marcus Ericsson has a win at the 500, a runner-up finish at the 500, but he also has two finishes above 30. I said in my blog, and I'll say it again here, you can guarantee two things about Marcus Ericsson at the 500. One, he will either be a contender, or two, it will certainly not be boring. And this was another case where strategically he drove a perfect race.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They called it perfect.
He turned a completely screwed pit stop into an alternate strategy, a third separate strategy from everyone else, saved enough fuel, was able to then pit later than everyone else to then have no fuel saved to the end, have the freshest tires to the end. Unfortunately, first step of it, Andretti just did not have the guns down the stretch, because even with all of that, Pelot sized up his inside. And then, I mean, those two were at 100% to finish out the race. 5-6 laps to the end, Pelot got loose, and I thought that was the end of my day.
Yeah.
Ericsson was following basically right in his wheel tracks. When one would bobble, the other would bobble. Such was the margin at which they were pushing.
Indeed.
The other shoe dropping. Well, he got
second. Came Monday.
Until he didn't, because both Andretti cars were disqualified for illegal modifications to their supplied ERS covers, as well as rear suspension joint modifications.
Andretti said it's taking the necessary time to assess the situation and, quote, will be requesting a full review with IndyCar, so that probably means they're going to appeal. Callum Ilott and Prema accepted their penalties, and that's a shame for him because he drove like a damn good race. We were talking about, like, should we be worried that Robert Schwartzman just blitzed him at qualifying? As it turns out, maybe just having a good race car was good enough for Callum, because he had a pretty decent race, penalty notwithstanding. Robert Schwartzman accidentally flipped some of his pit crew and his race was over.
Necessarily an accident. His rear brakes failed.
Yeah. That's why
they did not get that car back in the field. Either way, Schwartzman kind of got dropped like a bag of dirt as soon as the green flag flew. Was able to stay in the top five for a little bit, but just deteriorated throughout the race. It's what happens when you dump your entire practice load into setting the car up for qualifying. As mentioned, Ilott drove a great race.
Yeah,
he really did. It's a shame.
Like, he looked like he had the experience, like what we talked about going into the month with him versus Schwartzman, but disqualified for a left front wing end plate height irregularity. That one's pretty cut and dry. The Andretti ones, we'll see what happens. But much like the spec supplied part that Penske modified, there are certain things which are no touchy on an Indy car, and Andretti did.
And the thing about this, if Pelot doesn't make that pass and he doesn't benefit from DeFrancesco and Foster, I mean, people were saying that, like, DeFrancesco and Foster mucking it up at the front probably saved this year's Indy 500, because as impressive as Ericsson's race was, it would have been so, so awful if he won that race just to get it yanked away 24 hours later due to a technical infringement.
It's an unmitigated disaster that would have been richly celebrated, because American motorsport loves it when people low-key cheat. No, I'm joking. That's the filthy European and me kicking in there. No, it would have been a complete and unmitigated disaster for the series to come off the back of one cheating scandal in qualifying to have another take the win away from the most pomp and circumstance celebration in all of motorsport. You know, to have all the 500, you know, the kissing of the bricks, the drinking of
the milk,
you know, the media circles, all of that to end up with the winner disqualified would have been, it would have been a horror show for IndyCar.
And then you open the Pandora's box of them saying, well, they only disqualified it because they're an Andretti car and not a Penske car.
Well, they just disqualified a Penske car. I mean, like, if he had won that race and they didn't disqualify him, like, given the events of this month.
Yeah, you have to be consistent no matter whose name is on the car entry or not.
Especially when the owner of the series disqualified his own, a pair of his own cars from qualifying. That would have gone down like a lead balloon with the teams here. Given it's already gone down with a lead balloon, like some component suppliers who will remain nameless. They don't call out the supplier company for nothing.
Ding, ding.
Other than that, little Dave.
I told you, all he needed was a healthy wrist and a chance.
A year ago, this man had one hand and no ride. He just finished runner-up in the Indy 500 and beat Santino Ferrucci in his wheelhouse. First time of asking in the same team.
Ferrucci keeps his top 10 streak alive, but man, David Malukas, top five, top 10 again for Ferrucci, but David Malukas, I mean, his career pretty much hung by a thread, because even if he did get a ride, even if he did heal up, would he get another ride as good as the one that he got unceremoniously cut from at Arrow McLaren again? This AJ Foyt ride isn't really that.
Well, AJ Foyt is good at one place and one place only. But if you're going to be good at one place and one place only, it better be the Indy 500.
And Malukas has always been a strong oval driver since he got up into the series, Trey.
He's been an incredibly strong oval driver from day one. That's the one thing about David Malukas you can guarantee, besides mediocre memes on social media. Look, fair play to David. I didn't think he had it in him on this one, and I've been the first person to point out he's not had a good season up to this point. This was meant to be the, are you good enough to potentially be the heir to the Penske throne that Roger is seemingly selected him by? And he was 18th in the points going into this weekend, and he's now 10th as a result of the huge haul he picked up at this race. 47 points as a result of that finish, and of course combined with the qualifying as well, because he did make the fast 12 as well. Again, not a fluke. The car was damn quick. Malukas is an outstanding oval driver. He should have had an oval win by now. He's unlucky not to have had one by now, and he's just missed out again here. But that is a season saving performance from David Malukas. He needed a big result like that, and he got one.
Without question.
Double top five for AJ Foyt as well, and the team that desperately needed it, not only for just morale, but also winner's circle. Those points may come in very handy at the end of the season.
Just going to say as well, most underrated man in the entirety of IndyCar this year with another outstanding result, Felix Rosenqvist.
Oh my God. Fourth after penalties? You know,
why is no one talking about the fact that Felix Rosenqvist is not just fourth as a result of this race? He's now, I think, fourth in the championship.
Fourth in the championship. Look, it's a mile to stretch from him to Alex Palou like it is for everybody else, but he had a damn fine week at the Indy 500. Good. Remember,
good all month.
This race saved his career 3 years ago when he was on his last legs at McLaren and they were trying everything they could to get rid of him. He has a good Indy 500. It doesn't save his career at McLaren, of course, but it does keep his stock high in the sport after a frustrating 2021 season. And now 2025, it's got him in the conversation for at least a top three championship finish.
Yeah, so one of the absolute best qualifiers in the series, bar none, put that car fifth in qualifying. I mean, this result really, it took him higher in the standings. He'll welcome it with arms wide open. Tires looking a little weathered at the end of that race, but good job.
Boo! Good, Felix. Boo! You twat! Jesus Christ.
You know, there's a man who wasn't here to finish second again, and he didn't, because he finished third.
My pick, Pato O'Ward. Got close and just, I don't know whether it was fourth or fifth in the line syndrome because of all the dirty air. He just didn't have it this race. I don't understand why.
He flew by Rosenqvist like Rosenqvist had blown his engine. I'm like, okay, here we go.
Yeah. That was it. That was the moment that I thought
I thought that was Pato's go moment, and it just didn't get any further than that.
It just stopped there. He couldn't get by Malukas. Again, the strength of Malukas' car. Pretty much the only thing that could beat him was alternate strategy and Alex Palou. It just He just ran there for the whole race. He was just top five and not really any better.
Yeah, it's like Pato's car was like, I think Cam's spot on. I think Pato's car was top five, top six worthy pretty much all Fortnite, but never number one. And that was probably the biggest issue with Pato, was that he never had the outright fastest car here. And that's probably what ultimately held him back. Also, Pato, I heard that post-race interview. You salty bitch. Calling, I think it's a bit rich to call somebody else in the field a choker for not passing the RLL cars when, one, you finished second at this race three times. Two, you were beaten by Marcus Ericsson straight up. And if memory serves, you pulled out of a turn one overtake on the final lap of that race and made a business decision not to try and take him on. And in the year afterwards, you dive bombed him down the inside with seven to go on the freshest tires in the field. And the person you dive bombed was, and I'm checking my notes here, Marcus Ericsson.
Well, how did he come off of that dive bomb?
He wrecked himself. Now, call me crazy, I think that's a much bigger argument to being labeled a choker than not passing two genuinely quick cars that were still on the lead lap.
Yeah, okay. Just saying. Especially when Marcus Ericsson has a baby board and does not.
Can I read a sequence of tweets from May 19th, 2024?
Sure.
So does Andretti drop Ericsson at the end of the year and make a run at ILOT? He's used a setup for Rosenquist a bunch, clash with Herta, missed lap four here, and has struggled with place. Shrug emoji.
Well, this month was pretty good from Ericsson, disqualification notwithstanding. Yeah. The rest has still been mid to bad.
Yeah, like there is an air of two things can be true at once. Ericsson initially had a great 500, but we are also still talking about a man who is currently sitting 20th in the standings.
Yeah, that penalty really took the wind out of his sails, and it wouldn't have made much of a difference. But like,
Colton Herta ends up as best Andretti by doing absolutely nothing.
He is still a distant ninth in the standings. I mean, there were a lot of upset contenders. Takuma Sato, we talked about. Connor Daly, for stretches of this race, was the number one man of the A strategy. For Yoko's Hollinger Racing, he got the stone cold pops from the crowd every time he drove to the front. As expected, it just wasn't to be, because bad luck Connor is never not around the corner.
Yeah, to last stint, his right rear tire just fell apart on him while he was net P2, and he had to bail out earlier than he wanted to.
Ryan Hunter-Reay
in a pit stop practice chassis that had no speed in clean air, jack shit in clean air, was drafting those two RLL cars right to the end. Ran himself one lap too long and ran the car so out of fuel that it unprimed all of his fuel lines and the car died.
Brutal. A miscalculation on the math screwed him. That was so... It's sad. Honestly, it was genuinely hard to listen to Connor Daly's radio as his tire was falling apart him towards the back end of that penultimate stint. It was scary hearing the man panic saying, "Hit me or I'm going to crash," essentially.
He was 20-25 miles per hour off of the cars around him, going into the corners, which at that point is a hazard, but he had no choice. He still got a better net result out of it than if he had pitted early, but that's just the way the race broke for him.
Mm-hmm.
He's still really good here.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy. He doesn't need ECR setups to be good around here.
He genuinely had a top five car on race day that could have been a contender for the win if he was able to stay on sequence. But he just lost so much in the back end of that penultimate stint, he was never able to recover back to that lead group. I'm going to talk about Fox a little bit. And you know what? Fair play to Fox. This was the big deal. This was the reason why we were all here. And this was the reason why we were all excited about them taking over the coverage of this series. 7.05 million viewers, more than the Daytona 500, and the most for an Indy 500 since reunification in 2008.
Yeah. And actually, this has been revised today to 6.087 million. Okay, it's a slight bump.
It's still better than the Daytona 500. It's still the best showing since 08. When this sport was, frankly, in its death throes. And think, they did all that without a functioning timing tower or functional coverage for half the race.
There's so much that's weird about this broadcast because, like, the user interface, as we mentioned, the timing tower was just glitchy all day. We watched the international feed. We'd have cars swapping positions back and forth that really didn't swap positions. That was genuinely off-putting. It went out for a good chunk of the first half of the race. It went out at the speedway for the first chunk of the race, for that matter. That wasn't great. We still agree that while Will Buxton is doing a pretty good job, he's not Lee Diffie.
He, by the last, I would say, third of that race, he was falling into the, I don't have any energy anymore. I'm going to fall into cliches and aggrandized statements. It wasn't all bad.
No.
But chunks of it were not so good either. And the thing is, the other half of the 1100, and hilariously, Kyle Larson didn't even make 600 miles across both races.
Mm-hmm.
Later in the day, NASCAR had its first race on Amazon Prime. Now, I won't say it's perfect. The user interface for that is good on 4K TVs and nothing else, but it was really nice on my TV.
Yeah.
But I watched that broadcast and I thought, this is the best American racing broadcast I've seen in the last 10 to 15 years.
Because they knew that
everything that Fox has done in NASCAR and IndyCar thus far this year to shame.
It's incredible, like, just what can happen when you have the endless bucket of money that Amazon Prime Video can dump into a sports broadcast.
And that's implying that Fox doesn't have infinite money to web its sports broadcast. Yeah, they do with other ones.
They blew it all on weird AI synthetic ads of Michael Strahan pretending to be a race car driver instead of a football driver, which was just yuck.
Weird.
I didn't care for that.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I have to give Fox some due. They threw the house at this, like, and to the point where it actually got a little bit obnoxious because Derek Jeter and A-Rod don't normally show up for a 500. Rob Gronkowski doesn't normally show up for a 500. Nick Wright and Maurice Jones-Drew don't normally talk about IndyCar on First Things First. You know, Tom Brady doesn't normally roll up to do the lap behind the safety car. Fox pulled in a lot of favors. You know, a lot of body favors.
The winning wreath of the 500 is spoiled forever, being worn by Nick Wrong.
Right. He's hyping up Stingray Rob as a man to watch on First Things First, and I'm sitting there going,
that's so Nick Wright. That is such a Nick Wright take.
Did you see where Tom Brady posted to, like, one of his socials that he was like, I was just happy to get one more successful drive in front of a bunch of Colts fans.
Yeah.
Ironically, with Peyton Manning narrating the pre-race intro where they have the dramatization of the building of the speedway.
Yeah. Peyton Manning was on the voice. Yeah.
Huge amount of personnel, like personnel and star power at it. But the core broadcast just leaves me going, this is all the same stuff I complain about with their NASCAR coverage.
It's I used the Top Gear joke of when they're in America and they have to be factual, when it's like, oh, it's one of those really fancy American bodybuilders, all muscles, but when he put his pants down, it's hello, Mr. Squirrel Dick. And that's kind of what this felt like watching it. I don't fall head over heels for celebrity endorsements. And don't get me wrong, Fox did throw the house at that, as mentioned. But I've not even mentioned Al Michaels and Chris Myers and Erin Andrews and, you know, bringing back Danica Patrick. You know, they threw everything they had at this. And I can't say it didn't work. The number's the number. That's a 41% increase on last year. That's a huge gain. But as Cam quite rightly pointed out, I've said this about Buxton before, he was perfectly serviceable for most of that 500, but he still feels like the third wheel at a date that's a little bit awkward because there's not going to be a second date between Townsend Bell and James Hinchcliffe. Hinchcliffe is as usual as fantastic. He always has been.
Broadcast every weekend.
He's so fantastic at this. He's such a natural broadcaster. Townsend Bell was fine for the most part. He wasn't anywhere near as egregious as he normally has been, quite frankly.
Still some gentle Santino Ferrucci glaze in the middle of that race.
Of course, you know, and that's to be expected at this point, but he was serviceable otherwise. Buxton, as Cam quite said, Buxton ran out of gas in the final hour, and you've got to remember, this is a man who cut his teeth doing GP2 commentary, races that are normally 40 minutes long. Doing that for 3 hours instead is difficult. I'm not disputing that as a broadcaster. Yeah. I can't imagine how hard that can be at times, especially when it's your first time commentating a race that long in one stint is not for the faint of heart. I do get that. But he's still struggling a little bit for me. I think the whole thing felt a little bit hollow to watch, and the viewing experience, again, from Fox still isn't good. It's not fully on Fox. IMS Productions' truck has been shit all year, and I'm tired of defending them and them not getting the flack they deserve because their timing towels and their broadcast graphics have been bad all year long. There's been consistent timing tower and glitching and errors all year long. We're in May. How is this still happening? Quite frankly, like this, it's unacceptable for a broadcaster of their size that they're making these mistakes. You had months to get this right with Fox, and you're still screwing up. It's not acceptable. And as an audience, we should deserve better. But hey, you got 7 million viewers, so who gives a shit, right? You know, it's one of those ones. You look at the number and just go, well, fuck it, it worked. So, you know, it works.
I mean, as far as that shows how the mighty have fallen with the Daytona 500 at this point, because that race is just falling just further and race. Further. It's actually worse than that. It's falling further and further from prestige every year as they add more contrived BS and we have more fuel saving events. And Elton Sawyer says, what's there to fix? Look at all the passing.
It's like NASCAR now realizes how frustrating it is to not pop as big a number as the competition when you have either a good race, a mid race, or a terrible race.
I'll say a couple of extra points that I want. I'm going to be fair. I've been critical of some of the Fox elements. A few people I want to give some flowers to. James Hinchcliffe, again, outstanding as he is year on year. He is the best thing about IndyCar's broadcast team and has been from the moment he joined that crew. Jack Harvey did a very solid job juggling driving duties while also being a part-time broadcaster in his own right.
Yeah.
Jamie Little was superb.
Yeah.
Absolutely superb in the pit lane. And their interview with Roger Penske midweek was also outstanding. Fox needs to understand that what her talent is and stop trying to make her something that she's not. Mm-hmm. Because what she does do, she does extremely well, frankly. Her and Georgia Henneberry were superb in the pit lane all fortnight long, consistently excellent. Like Georgia's picked up where I remember when Katie Hargett used to do this when I first started watching this series. She's more than picked up that baton and ran with it since. Again, it's the people that you don't talk about as much that are the ones that carry the broadcast, and they were all exceptional. And it's always fun seeing Tony Stewart on a table. But I'll always say that. Tony is never dull. Yeah.
He's the normal one at that table.
And also,
that is a terrifying statement.
I'll give the commentary box this as well, and this goes for the whole promotion of the event. The Weenie 500 was outstanding entertainment.
Oh, my God.
I'm so disgusted that this was rigged for Slaw Dog to take the victory.
I lost the mortgage on the New York dog. That is the gold standard of dogs. And what happens? We get jumped at the start. And now I don't know how I'm going to keep the roof of my head. I'm kidding. Please, if you have a gambling problem, seek help.
No, it's like if you're going to rig this, you rigged it for the fucking Slawdog of all people. Like, ridiculous.
Typical Penske favoritism, am I right?
Of course.
But we all know that the Slawdog is representing the Southeast, and Cam, where is Penske's headquarters?
North Carolina.
No, that tracks. No, the commentary for that race was hilarious. They clearly were practicing their puns, and they pulled it off extremely well. It was a very funny, entertaining race. Yeah. And it was the second best brand activation in the motorsport we've seen this month. Bad luck, guys. You just missed out to F1 playing Lego, because that was funny as hell. Mm-hmm. Bad luck. any other month, it would have been perfect.
Right? And if you want to know how previous previewer of this race, Chris DeHarty's picks went, well, the weenie that he picked exploded.
Yeah, we had a wienermobile mechanical failure. I'm not sure if it was just like a little bit of sports entertainment or if that was like a shoot blow up, but I didn't expect to see that.
No, they had us going there for a few minutes there, and it was, like I said, it was great fun, so fair play to them there. Just to put a neat little bow on all of this, of course, you've got to talk about Alex Palou, and I think I'll grab this one first, because I know what you two fuckers are going to say. Right off the rip.
Arguing the wall.
No, and I hold my hands up. I had no idea who Alex Palou was when you two idiots recommended him on this podcast, when he had just won at Super Formula in Fuji back in 2019, where he beat the field by 13 seconds, and you said he's going to IndyCar next year, and you thought, hang on, this kid might be something. He qualified fast 12 on debut in his first attempt to win this race, and I still didn't see it. He goes and joins the number 10 at Chip Ganassi, the fable number 10, and I thought he's probably just going to be another notch on the bedpost, because they'd ran through so many people trying to make that number 10 work, from Felix Rosenquist to Ed Jones. Tony Kanaan, of course, was at the back end of his career by the time he moved on from them. I don't think even these two bumbling fools would have ever imagined Alex Palou would turn out to be this.
You don't win that first race in Super Formula in those conditions without being a bit special.
No, and but I didn't believe it.
This is like 10. This is just when you think he has his ceiling, he punches up a skyscraper above that. I mean, he was in the final running for Driver of the Year on this podcast in 2023 and lost out to the statistical greatest Formula One season we've ever seen. His average finish was what, 5.3?
Yeah.
It's 1.17.
What more can you say that hasn't already been said? I mean, look,
he's putting together a Nobody's Perfect poster, an IndyCar, a series designed for that to not be possible.
Look, and he had ticked every box you could imagine in IndyCar going into this year. And look, if you ever want a message about how the powers that be looked at this series, who got the first advert on TV when Fox picked up the series? It wasn't Alex Palou, it was Joseph Newgarden. No, get me wrong, there was perfectly good reasons for that. Joseph is one of the best in 500 history. He's top six on the all-time wins list. He is going to end with an incredible career if it ended tomorrow, and he's an incredibly handsome, marketable face of the franchise. Totally understandable. So, you know, I get why Newgarden was that first pick, but Alex Palou was next in line, and they did a very good job of telling people the exact scope of Palou's career, a professor of precision, someone with an unbelievable nous and knack for racing, but also the key line in there in the middle of that advert. This is why he's a grown man haunted by milk, mocking the fact that he had not won the 500 yet, the one piece of the puzzle that he was missing, the fact he had not won on an oval, the fact he had a couple of second places on ovals but had never actually won one. He did it.
He finished second to one man beat him in 2021 at this race, first time of asking for Ganassi.
Mm.
A man by the name of Elio Castroneves. who, by the way, had a pretty good Sunday as well. Not exactly. Arguably, statistically, the greatest driver to ever grace the speedway.
And it's one of those things where I wasn't sure. I mean, look, the signs were there. He nearly beat Helio on his second attempt when Helio won his fourth. He used to be the all-time pole position record speed holder. He was the first man, you know, to ever do a 234-mile-an-hour run in the pole position run in the speedway's history. He's always been in the mix, but he would never quite gone over the hump on that one. And this was the one. He was pretty much flawless for the entire 2 weeks that we run this race in prep for the big dance. On top of being virtually perfect, on top of the entirety of this season, as it is. And to all those out there that suddenly want to get in my Blue Sky mentions, I give you a message. Alex Palou does not need Formula One to validate his greatness. He's never needed it. He definitely doesn't need it now. That door is closed. He doesn't need to be a Formula One driver to prove himself because he's already one of the greatest IndyCar drivers the series has ever seen. Yeah. And this 500 seals the deal on that. He is the Dario successor. Simple as that.
If he were Nancy. You have your heir.
If he retired right then and there, he's one of the 20th greatest drivers in the sport's history off of his resume. I don't think he's number 20.
No.
He's got one hand on a four faster cup in 5 years.
It's like he's speedrunning Scott Dixon's career.
By the way, lost in all of this because of how his race went, Did we all just forget that Scott Dixon just set the all-time IndyCar Ironman record for the most starts?
Unfortunately, it almost wasn't a start because he had a left rear brake caliper failure at the same time Scott McLaughlin walled it. We thought they were related, but they were too far apart on the grid to be related anyway. And very, very bad day for Oceanic Scotts.
No.
Very, very bad day. Very bad. Because Dixon's car was arguably just as fast as Palou's up to this point. He had a quick car in the race, but three laps down to start your day. And Kiffin Simpson, the other Ganassi, low-key, one of my better drivers of the month, kept his nose clean right up until the point where Kyle Larson cut it off. When he money shifted on a restart, spun himself and wiped out both Simpson and Stingray Rob. Stingray, that's what you get for trying to ban pornography in the United States. What a weird 500. The first half of this race is the weirdest that I can remember in living memory.
Yeah. Vibes are off. It wasn't an all-time classic, but not Dre, I'm pretty sure we can all agree that the right person won.
And that's a rare thing to say about an Indy 500 because it's a race about shocks. It's a race about drama. It's a race that's built around shenanigans, surprise, strategy, and more often than not, the best person doesn't win. One of the most historic phrases that goes alongside this race is the Speedway chooses its winner. And for once, maybe for the first time, since I've actually been watching IndyCar for, and this is, I think, my 10th season watching now, truly, I can say the right man won this race. Because no one in that field, in terms of sheer quality of driving in the last half decade, has deserved to win a 500 more than Alex Palou. He has been the real face of the franchise. He has been the real outstanding measuring stick for quality in this series, and there are no more questions left to answer. There are no more worlds left for him to conquer. This was the one, and I will never, it's like the same way that I will never forget Helio's Nesquik packet and climbing of the fence, the same way that I will never forget Joseph Newgarden jumping into the crowd, which was the definition of a Newgarden moment. Yeah. I will never forget Alex Palou running down the yard of bricks, throwing his gloves in the air as his dad, who's in tears, is the first man to hug him on the other side of the fence.
Yeah,
it was a legendary moment.
Just about tackled him down onto the pavement. In Victory Lane, couldn't have happened to a nicer guy as well. The first thing he asked about with his Victory Lane celebrations, if he won, is he wants a little bottle of milk for his daughter. He raised the milk before he didn't dump it on his head. The rare actually drinking the milk, because my previous boy, Simon Pagino, didn't drink a sip. He just dumped that right on top of his head. Didn't have a care in the world.
So waste of good milk.
But not only raised it to his entire team and Chip before he sipped, but then in reference to what has happened between him and Ganassi and McLaren a couple of years ago, in the victory gala the next day, was talking about how, like, all he can do is keep trying to win races as a thank you and a I'm sorry to this team that has been giving him rocket ships for the last couple of years.
It's so easy to forget he nearly blew this all up for an F1 seat that he thought was there, that probably was never there at all to begin with. And he still feels like he owes this team something after all the drama and chaos that there's no getting around it. He put them through.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I think ultimately Chip stood by him was because he knew how fucking good he was. And
get a turn on that investment for those court dates.
And at this point, Alex, I think, is more than atoned for his previous sin, because look at what he has given back to that team. He's put the DHL car at the front of the field. He's won Chip 3 Aster Cups. He's probably going to win him a 4th by the end of the year, and who knows how much more. But he's also got Chip another 500 win, his 2nd in 4 years. It's an incredible accomplishment for a driver that, quite frankly, is every bit the company man and ambassador for the series that we say others are. I just think that I think he gets a bit of a bad rap for being almost, he's like the Luke Humphreys of IndyCar compared to darts, where it's like he's almost too nice for his own good, and people look at that like it's a sign of weakness for some stupid reason.
They can say that. When he put the visor down, I mean, when he passed Ericsson, that was as last second as you get going, you are going to give me this corner or we're both going out of this race. He is a killer when he puts the visor down. And then when he takes his helmet off, he is the nicest, the most disgustingly nice man.
I remember what's that too.
Yeah. And was talking about, I mean, after the race, went to sleep and then he woke up at 3 a.m. and couldn't process it.
Bless him. And then the terrifying thing about all this is, the most terrifying thing about this all this, he's 28.
Yeah,
he's got 15 more years of this if he wants it.
Yeah,
15, and he's the most talented driver IndyCar has had probably since Joseph, and Joseph was special in his own right too. Mm-hmm. Simon Pagenaud, to a degree, was special. Yeah, his prime window was short, but when it was there, it was mighty.
Scott Dario.
In terms of just the... If Alex Palou is now the all-tool driver, where he can, if he can replicate this on the short ovals, he is your Dario regen, except maybe even better. And as a Dario fan from long ago, that is a terrifying statement.
What a talent, what a driver. And
Chip likes winners.
It's as simple as that.
He's got one.
Safe to say he's got one. IndyCar is back this weekend. Hey, did you forget? This is when the title campaign gets busy.
This is when we come down from the high and we remember Detroit from last year.
Yeah, we're really encouraging people to tune into Detroit and keep these numbers up. I'll be there. I'll say hi.
Yeah.
One thing I can guarantee. It will not be boring.
No. There's one thing we can say about Detroit. It's never been dull since we moved over to GMHQ. So you keep your eyes on that for this weekend. We've also going to have a Formula One review next week because we've got the penultimate Spanish Grand Prix at Barcelona. It's going to be around for 26, but probably not more beyond that. That'll be one to keep an eye on. Flexi Wingate. We'll talk about that a little bit more in the F1 episode coming up next. But until then, I've been Dre Harrison. They've been Cameron Buckley and RJ O'Connell. Thank you very much for listening. And until next time, in the words of Lee Diffy, hello, Polo.
Later, y'all.
Everything went red and yellow for 500 miles. Woke up sipping milk. Aw, man, I did it again.